So it's my great pleasure to welcome Tim Cronin back to Swarthmore as our colloquium speaker today. Tim graduated from Swarthmore in 2006, and as a student, Tim worked with Professor Amy Graves on questions about the lifetime of positronium inside of variously shaped cavities, with the goal of using measurements of its lifetime to learn about small defects in materials. Tim's thesis was one of three American Physical Society APGAR Award finalists for Best Undergraduate Thesis in 2006, and the commendation that he received can still be seen in the physics office to this day. The work that he did with Professor Graves led to a publication co-authored with a few other people titled Simulation of Positronium Toward More Realistic Models of Void Spaces in Materials. That's a cool title. Tim graduated from here with an honors major in physics, an honors minor in math, and he received the Lang Award for Outstanding Academic Accomplishment. So after Swarthmore, Tim went on to work at the Ecosystem Center at MBL in Woods Hole, Massachusetts. It's not the Marine Biology Lab, it's just MBL. Is that true, Chen? Okay. So Chen spent the summer there last summer. And he worked in the Terrestrial Ecosystems Modeling Group. He then went on to MIT to work on a PhD, was a postdoc at Harvard, and is now an assistant professor of atmospheric science at MIT. So I just want to give you a little sense of some of the things that Tim has thought about in the projects he's worked on. He's developed a theory for the sensitivity of surface temperatures to changes in land properties, which is relevant for understanding how human land use and land cover may have resulted in past and future climate change. He's also worked on trying to understand why it rains preferentially over islands in the tropics, a fact I did not know, but that's fascinating. Isn't that an awesome question? And whether geologic changes around Indonesia have implications for climate changes over the past 3 to 5 million years. So a whole range of interesting topics. So today, Tim is going to talk to us about what we can still learn about climate from radiative convective equilibrium. Let's welcome Tim back to Swarthmore.
Thanks for the introduction and for the invitation, Tristan. I really appreciate it. And it's great to be back here. I have many good memories of this place, and it's fun to be back as a speaker. So I have these three somewhat cryptic numbers on the left that I've put up here as a puzzle. If you spread out that water in liquid form uniformly over the Earth's surface. So surface waters from the ocean and glaciers, it's about 4 kilometers deep, average ocean depth, 3/4 of the globe. You spread that out, it's 3 kilometers. All the water vapor in the atmosphere, if you condensed it out and rained it out on the surface, spread it out uniformly, would be about 2.5 centimeters or an inch. All of the clouds in the atmosphere, liquid and ice, if you just dropped them out of the atmosphere all at the same time, spread them on a layer on the surface, would be only 0.1 millimeters of thickness, so 2 human hairs. So water vapor is a tiny fraction of total water in the Earth system, and cloud water is a tinier component still, less than 1%. Yet clouds are really this vivid and highly dynamic aspect of Earth's climate and very strongly affect Earth's energy balance. So satellites make this obvious that atmospheric water in its multiple forms has a profound effect on Earth's energy balance, with clouds being by far the most radiatively important form of water on Earth. So this is true both for solar energy gained by the Earth system and for infrared energy radiated by the Earth back out to space. So both directions of energy gain and energy loss, both sides of the energy balance or climate equation are regulated by water and vapor and condensed forms in the atmosphere. I want to clarify that at the start of this talk that if I say infrared or IR, what I mean is the thermal infrared part of the spectrum from about 5 to 50 microns wavelength, which is where nearly all of the energy loss from the Earth system out to space takes place, or the wavelength range where that takes place, and where there's very little incident solar flux. So it's not sunlight that you're seeing in those wavelengths. So in the visible, as in the top image, bright regions indicate clouds. This was from a few days ago. I think there was a tropical disturbance near Florida and this big band of clouds from a mid-latitude weather system stretching across the country. So you can see that bright reflective regions, the brightest regions are all clouds. In the infrared, as in the bottom image, bright regions indicate less heat radiated out to space. So these less warm regions in the infrared correspond to cold cloud tops, which you can match up to the cloud patterns seen in the top image, and also to regions where there's a lot of water vapor in the atmosphere. So say over the Gulf of Mexico, less radiation is escaping out to space. The darker regions, on the other hand, are regions where the atmosphere is drier. So some parts of the American Southwest and some parts of the East Coast as well in this image. Since this is a wavelength for water vapor is a really strong absorber, as well as clouds having an effect on the radiation budget. So the major role of clouds in Earth's energy balance and their ephemeral and often very small spatial scales of formation and dissipation is really difficult to get right in global climate models. This is in part because global climate models have grid boxes that are 100 kilometers on a side, which is much bigger than individual clouds or even cloud systems usually are. So this difficulty in realistically simulating clouds in global models means that these models rely heavily on assumptions about how clouds relate to the larger scale properties of an atmospheric grid box, like its humidity, temperature, and so on. And this makes us particularly uncertain about how clouds will change in a changing climate. For example, one way that the clouds could change would be that there would be less clouds in a warmer climate and they would reflect less sunlight. And that would be a positive feedback on climate change, because less reflection of sunlight, more absorption leads to more heating of the Earth system, which could feed back onto less clouds, more warming, and so on. And the exact opposite is also possible, more cloudiness in a warmer world, leading to more reflected sunlight and damping or reducing the effects of CO2 on climate change. So this is a plot that shows how much of the difference in climate sensitivity or climate temperature response to a change in CO2 between models occurs due to different processes. So two substantial uncertainties are in red here, which is called forcing, which models don't agree exactly on how much less energy is lost to space when you add greenhouse gases to the atmosphere, in part because the models add different amounts of greenhouse gases, and in part because of the radiative effects of greenhouse gases also depend on the cloud field and water vapor and other aspects of the modeled climate. The blue bar here is also a major as a substantial uncertainty, which is that we don't know exactly how much water vapor will change in a warm climate and what its vertical distribution will be, and thus how it will tend to amplify climate change. The amount to which it amplifies, the water vapor feedback amplifies climate change, is uncertain. But the biggest bar by far is the brown one, which is that of clouds. So indicating that model differences in how changes in clouds will work in a warmer world is a major uncertainty. This dominates the spread in predictions of global warming. This is often where people stop. They say we need to narrow the spread of cloud feedbacks in order to better predict future climate change. But this is not just a problem for prediction. This is a fundamental problem of scientific understanding. If I could build a perfect climate model that would tell us the number for how much global mean surface temperature would change in response to doubling CO2, or how much precipitation would change in each region, or how much temperature would change in each region, that would still be super scientifically unsatisfying. It would just be a black box that you were querying. We want to understand why. And so what I want to talk about, build up to talking about today, and I'm not going to get to an answer on it, but I want to talk about how we're trying to make progress as a field in atmospheric and climate science in trying to understand why and how clouds might change with warming, not just predicting a change like a black box. So I want to talk about how we can use numerical modeling in the very idealized setup of radiative convective equilibrium as an experimental tool to probe that question. And to do that, I'm going to talk about work that I've done over the past few years using fluid dynamical models of the atmosphere that explicitly simulate turbulent convection, so the rising warm and moist air in clouds, and cloud formation. And radiative convective equilibrium is a simplified model setup to ask these basic questions about primarily how tropical clouds might change with global warming. I'll spend a bunch of time introducing radiative convective equilibrium, so don't worry if you don't know what that is right now. The first main line of research that I want to talk about is studying how and why clouds tend to clump together or aggregate in radiative convective equilibrium in simulations. So this is work that I've done with collaborator Allison Wing. He's a professor at Florida State University, and also with Tom Buechler, who's a fourth-year graduate student of mine at MIT. And the second main line of research that I want to talk about is looking at how the clouds in these simulations change with warming, which is mainly diagnostic for the time being, but also how the clustering of clouds affects the cloud feedback, or how the aggregation of clouds in the basic state climate affects how they change with warming. And this is work also done with Allison Wing from Florida State. And I want to acknowledge support from the NSF too. So the main results are that we're finding increasing evidence that the tropical atmosphere may prefer to self-aggregate its convection and clouds into preferentially moist regions, which leaves the rest of the atmosphere preferentially dry. Or in other words, the tropical atmosphere might be unstable to separating out from a uniform state into a state with parts of it being moist and parts of it being dry. We're still working to understand what mechanisms lead to this separation in numerical models and whether these physical mechanisms also operate in a much more complicated real world. And it seems from the other line of work that this self-aggregation modestly reduces climate sensitivity. So self-aggregation or clumping of clouds together, leaving other dry areas, reduces the water vapor feedback by creating these dry patches that can radiate efficiently out to space. But the effects are not really large. They're not a halving of climate sensitivity or anything like that. There's, order 10 to 20% effect on climate sensitivity. The effects of aggregation on cloud feedbacks is at the moment less clear, but that's one of the things that I'm actively working to try to figure out. So this talk will have four main parts. Parts one and two are really introduction to the subject. I'm going to first talk about some background, more detail on Earth's energy balance and how water in its multiple forms mediates the gain and loss of energy in the Earth system, and hopefully do a little demo. Then I'm going to talk about what radiative convective equilibrium is, why it might be a useful minimal model setup for understanding changes in clouds with warming and other problems as well. And then in the last two parts, I'll talk about the research that I've been involved with that I just alluded to on self-aggregation of clouds in radiative convective equilibrium, and also on climate feedbacks in both aggregated and disaggregated cloud states of radiative convective equilibrium. So the first thing that I want to do is give a little more background on how water in liquid, vapor, and ice forms dominates Earth's energy balance. So this is a figure from the IPCC, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, which shows the major globally averaged vertical energy transports in the Earth's climate system in watts per square meter of surface area. So there's, on average, about 340 watts per meter squared of energy incident from the sun. About a third of that gets reflected, and the net of these two is about 235 watts per meter squared, which is the same as this outgoing long wave radiation or infrared energy emitted from the Earth to space because the Earth is hot. And so almost all of these fluxes of energy are primarily mediated by water. The solar energy incident on Earth depends on the Earth's distance from the sun and the luminosity of the sun, which are not water-dependent quantities. And the conduction of heat from the surface to the atmosphere and subsequent transport by warm rising air motions and sinking cold air motions, or this heat exchange that's called thermals here, is also independent of water. It's something that would happen for a dry atmosphere and a dry planet. But clouds completely dominate the reflection of solar radiation by the climate system. Liquid and solid water are most of the surface area of the Earth, so they dominate both absorption and reflection at the surface. Absorption in the atmosphere, even though it's often taught that ozone is the big absorber, most of the absorption is by water vapor. So most of the heat transported turbulently from the surface to the atmosphere occurs in the form of clouds and through moist convection. So this loss of heat at the surface, evapotranspiration or evaporative cooling at the surface, and then subsequent warming of the atmosphere as that vapor condenses are both directly water-related in multiple forms. Then the amount, so most of the surface is ocean, so the upward radiation of energy from the surface is also dominantly from water, but this was the other arrow I considered crossing off, since a rock surface would basically emit the same amount of infrared energy if it were the same temperature. But all of the rest of these arrows are very, very strongly influenced by water, water vapor and clouds. So the amount of infrared heat that escapes at the top of the atmosphere is a result of how much is emitted at the surface and then how much of that is masked by greenhouse gases in the atmosphere and other substances like clouds that are opaque in the infrared. And the downward infrared radiation absorbed at Earth's surface is coming back from the atmosphere. This back radiation arrow here in the infrared is mostly due to emission from water vapor and clouds. So note that this arrow is actually twice as big as the solar absorption at the surface. So infrared radiation back to the surface from the atmosphere supplies the surface with about twice as much energy on average on time and over the globe as sunlight does to the surface. So it's like there are two infrared suns always in the sky and we just can't see them. So I think this is really cool. I want to take a few minutes to talk about how we can better visualize and understand two of the key related elements of the greenhouse effect better using infrared cameras, which allows us to see, to visually see two of the fluxes on this right side of the plot. So first I want to talk about this one, and then I'll talk about this one, which are basically different perspectives on the greenhouse effect. The surface perspective, where there's energy coming downward from the atmosphere in the infrared, and a top of atmosphere perspective, where the total loss of energy from the climate system is reduced below what would happen in the absence of greenhouse substances in the atmosphere. So the first thing I want to show is that we can directly observe that downward IR arrow from the sky using a handheld infrared camera. So this guy, which is about $500, not that expensive. So I took this picture in late August on a fairly humid day with a partly cloudy sky. You can see in the visible picture that comes along with the infrared picture on the right. What this camera is doing is measuring the amount of infrared energy flux incident in each pixel, you know, focused through a lens that can do infrared optics, and converting it to the equivalent temperature a black body would need to have to emit that same amount of heat using the Stefan-Boltzmann law. So recall that the Stefan-Boltzmann law says that a black body emits as the fourth power of the absolute temperature, which is in Kelvin, with a proportionality constant sigma, which has this value, watts per meter squared for Kelvin to the fourth. And so here you can see that some parts of the sky are much, much warmer or brighter than others in the infrared. Specifically, there are some low clouds here that look dark that are much, much warmer than the blue sky you see in this space between the blue sky up here, which goes down to temperatures of minus 17 or about 255 Kelvin, which is still much warmer than the 3 Kelvin of outer space. So I can estimate the downwards IR flux from this whole skyscape if I take a representative average temperature, say 0 degrees C or 273 Kelvin, and apply the Stefan-Boltzmann law to that, so sigma times 273 to the fourth, which comes out to be about 315 watts per meter squared. But if you look up at the sky with a camera like this on different days, you see very different amounts of downward infrared radiation or a very different effective sky temperature. On a clear day, with a very, you know, crisp autumn day with a dry atmosphere, you would see something like minus 40. And if the whole sky were covered with clouds, you would see everything looking like this if the surface temperature were this warm. So I think this is really cool. You can just see the greenhouse effect at the surface if you have an infrared camera. And the reason I want to take a detour, the reason why clouds are so radiatively active per unit mass is related to the reason that clouds don't just fall out of the sky, which is that they're suspensions of tiny, tiny droplets in the atmosphere, or ice crystals, with an emphasis on the tiny part of that again. So a very small amount of mass per unit ground area, say that global average value of around 100 grams per square meter, has a very, very large surface area. So a collection of particles that were all, say, all 10 microns in radius, with 100 grams per meter squared, would have a cross-sectional surface area of over 7 square meters of surface area per unit ground surface area. So that would mean that a beam of sunlight going through the atmosphere would have to pass through at least, on an average, 7 droplets of water before making it to the ground. Or an infrared photon going upwards would have to elude capture by 7 water droplets before making it out to space. And physically, the spectroscopic properties of liquid water and ice are such that cloud droplets and ice crystals are relatively transparent in the visible. So what they do instead of absorbing light that's coming in from the sun is that they scatter it because they have a different index of refraction compared to the air around them. But they're opaque in the thermal infrared. So any infrared light that's incident on them, they absorb. And then they also emit as black bodies at whatever temperature the cloud is. So due to those differences, it means that cloud droplets end up scattering light in the visible, looking bright, and they end up absorbing strongly and also emitting in the infrared, which can make them either look bright if you're looking up from the surface, or look, make them look cold, or if you're looking down from outer space. And so I want to do a little demo of the greenhouse effect from the top of atmosphere perspective by making a cloud in a bucket and showing how it obscures an object, not only in the visible, but also in the infrared. So I'm going to break up this humidifier. This is not a fancy piece of equipment. This is a standard issue humidifier that makes cloud droplets, basically, which subsequently evaporate into the air if you're letting them do that, and that humidifies your room. However, if you put it down into a bucket where it can't all evaporate, it's going to make a cloud. It's going to stay there. And so this humidifier produces droplets that are, you know, roughly the same size as are found in clouds, order of magnitude. So I'm going to try to stream video with this infrared camera as I put a hot object of water down into the cloud. And as I do that, you should see the bottle, the cup of water dim or go out of view, because its infrared emission is going to be replaced by the emission from the cooler cloud above, which is about at room temperature. So let's try that. So this is the infrared camera. You can see that all of you are warm, and there are some cold objects in between, like that water bottle right there, and the sherbet in the back, maybe something else. Yeah, there's the sherbet. So a bit of a cloud is built up in here. I'm going to take this thermos of hot water that's double-walled, so it's still going to be quite hot. And if I look at that, what I see is, not surprisingly, a really hot cup of water. It's about 65 degrees Celsius. If I look down at the cloud, what I see is basically room temperature, 22 degrees Celsius. And I can also show you guys what it looks like in the visible. You know, there's the humidifier floating out of the cloud. Not super high resolution, that's fine. But back into the infrared. This is actually a mixed mode where it's measuring infrared and then trying to look for surf lines from the visible so it can outline actual features. So maximum of 36 degrees C. You can actually see a plume of hot cloud coming off of the cup of water. But basically, what's happening is that this is the essence of the greenhouse effect. The hot Earth wants to emit to space at its temperature, but what you see from outer space as that beam of infrared radiation gets absorbed by the greenhouse gases and cloud substances in the atmosphere is instead a signal of the surface that's masked and replaced in part by the cooler atmosphere above. So this is now, looks a little warmer, but it's nowhere near as warm as the 70 degrees C that it is actually. I should turn this off because the humidifier doesn't like it when it's actually immersed in a cloud. And this also highlights the kind of ephemeral nature that I was talking about clouds, that I can just, you know, dump this out and it's going to go away. And most clouds, in fact, dissipate from evaporation, mixing into dry air, rather than raining out their water substance. So, again, this is a demo that shows the essence of the greenhouse effect from a planetary perspective of energy loss. So that's, the Earth system loses less energy to space in the infrared than it would if it were just seeing surface emission out to space. Because the atmosphere is colder than the surface, and the atmosphere has opacity in the infrared. It's not transparent to light in the infrared. So as this stream of surface radiation passes upwards through the atmosphere, it's attenuated, it's absorbed by the greenhouse substances in the atmosphere, and it's replaced by a stream of radiation that's coming from the colder atmosphere. So in the real atmosphere, the greenhouse effect of water vapor and clouds are the dominant things that affect the greenhouse effect. But CO2 and other greenhouse gases that humans are adding to the climate system still matter because they absorb and emit in wavelengths where water vapor doesn't. And the abundance of water vapor is controlled to first order by surface temperature. So it's a feedback which is affected by the temperature change that is caused by other radiatively active greenhouse gases. Okay, so this brings me to the subject of what is radiative convective equilibrium. So radiative convective equilibrium is a local statistical equilibrium state of Earth's atmosphere that accounts for the vertical heat transport by radiation and convection in the absence of large-scale lateral forcing of lateral heat transport or moisture transport, and also the absence of any horizontal heterogeneity in the boundary conditions. So the same sunlight, imagining what the Earth's climate would be like if it had the same sunlight everywhere, the same surface everywhere. And the result is a long-term energetic equilibrium or balance in the atmosphere between the atmosphere radiatively cooling to space and convective heating of the atmosphere due to rising warm and moist air and clouds primarily. So there's no imposed weather such as large-scale winds that can heat or cool or moisten or dry this system. The only external forcing is the sun and any prescribed concentrations of long-lived greenhouse gases. Water vapor is usually free to vary. So what radiative convective equilibrium solutions for the atmospheric temperature structure usually look like is that they have a convective lowermost layer of the atmosphere, or troposphere, which comes from the Greek root word of turning, so overturning, the way convection does in a pot of water. This troposphere looks like it's not much of the atmosphere here, but it contains most of the mass of the atmosphere because it's at highest pressures. And so the amount of the atmosphere, it's typically 80% of the atmosphere, atmospheric mass in the troposphere. And that's the troposphere overturns because the profile of temperature that it would have in the absence of convection, for this pure radiative equilibrium line, would be unstable to convective overturning. So it would have very, very warm air underneath very, very cold air, which would be unstable to convection. And the other feature of radiative convective equilibrium profiles is that they have a stratosphere that's in nearly radiative equilibrium, so there's no convective stirring in that part of the atmosphere, just a happy radiative balance between absorbed sunlight and emitted infrared radiation. So this is not a new finding. This is a figure from a paper published in 1964, so over 50 years ago. This was from a paper that was looking at the question of how Earth's average surface temperature would respond to changes in atmospheric greenhouse gases, clouds, surface albedo, other things. This was done with a single column model of the atmosphere that's extremely primitive by modern standards, but such single column models suffer from the limitation that they don't have convection explicitly. They're just making some assumptions, in this case, about how the atmospheric temperature profile, what the atmospheric temperature profile would be if a layer is unstable to convection. So this model makes the assumption that it's just 6.5 Kelvin per kilometer if a layer is made more unstable, so having a higher temperature gradient with height than that, it just relaxes back to 6.5 Kelvin per kilometer. And as a consequence of not modeling convection in any explicit way, these single column models also have a hard time doing any simulation of convective clouds that's reasonable, because the convective clouds result from condensation that occurs as warm, moist air rises through the atmosphere and condenses as it cools. So models like this often make a lot of assumptions about clouds that aren't very well substantiated. So this early simulation just said, we'll take Earth's global average cloud profile and put that in. And that continues to be a not unreasonable thing to do in a single column model, because it's really hard to make good predictions about clouds in this sort of model. So you can use a model like this to look at how much warming would take place from a doubling of CO2, but that you would need to hold the cloud distribution fixed or make some other set of assumptions. So a more modern perspective on radiative convective equilibrium is to use convection-permitting fluid dynamical models of the atmosphere. And so these models are typically doubly periodic, or so they basically, if a cloud were to move out, this cloud here is the same as this cloud here. It's a cloud complex that's occurring, you know, at the same part of the domain. If this cloud moved out this side, it would come in over here. If something moved out here, it would go in here. And they typically have horizontal grid spacing of something like 0.5 to 4 kilometers, with this upper end being pretty crude. Arguably, this lower end is also still kind of crude resolution, but one of the things we want to do with models like this is get to simulate big domains, and those two things come at a trade-off. So horizontal grid spacing in climate models, in modern climate models, is still around 100 kilometers. So this is a box like this would be in a global climate model. It would be a poor way of capturing, say, the cloud field that was in this section of the domain in many ways. And the other thing to note about this sort of resolution is that it can't, for mathematical reasons in the equations of motion, simulate the sort of actual updrafts that form clouds at smaller scales. The surface is usually assumed to be homogeneous as an ocean. I've actually shown this snapshot is from a simulation I did in my thesis that had an island in the middle of ocean. So I was looking at the sea breeze and thunderstorms that developed over the island in this background state. But that's unusual. Most of the time, everything's just a And they will often prescribe sea surface temperature. And that's a thing that, that deserves a little bit more explanation, because I've talked about this as an energy balance problem. And if you prescribe sea surface temperature, you're basically giving the climate a heat source or sink that depends on whether the climate, whether the atmosphere wants to be colder or warmer than that prescribed sea surface temperature. The reason to do that is because simulations become much less computationally expensive. You need to run them for less time to reach equilibrium if you fix the sea surface temperature, because you allow the system to have a heat reservoir to exchange with that's at fixed temperature. And the thing that we want to do is we want to study the distribution of rainfall rates or the radiative fluxes at the top of the atmosphere. How do they depend on sea surface temperature? And we can relate the problem of global energy balance with interactive surface temperatures or prognostic surface temperatures to the one of fixed, how do fluxes change at fixed surface temperature. And the other reason to use fixed surface temperature is that we often have in mind this as a reasonable background climate state for the Earth's tropics, but not necessarily for other parts of the Earth. So in the Earth's tropics, the dominant heat transports are vertical, and there is little horizontal heterogeneity in forcing in a lot of places. So large swaths of the tropical ocean are relatively the same temperature. They're not subject to the same sort of transient high and low pressure systems that you see in middle latitudes or a jet stream or anything like that that would complicate this and make this a kind of not a useful picture to look at.
Tim, just to make sure I understand that point, you're still running the model to equilibrium, but you're picking which equilibrium it's going to get to by setting that temperature.
So you'll get an atmospheric temperature profile that corresponds to your choice of SST and is also conditioned on the other forcing parameters that you choose, how strong the sun is, what the surface albedo and greenhouse gases are, that sort of thing.
Right.
Yep. Yep.
So to my understanding, what the systems are chaotic, so what does it mean for the system to find equilibrium?
So it's a statistical equilibrium. So the clouds here would never look the same at one time snapshot as the next. That's a great question. You would end up with a statistical representation of the cloud field that you could understand in terms of its expected values, its variance, and so on. And the temperature, mean temperature profile and its variance with height, that sort of thing. Yeah, so atmospheric energy balance is still attained with fixed SST, and the atmosphere evolves towards a statistical equilibrium state. Okay, so this brings up my first research topic, which is that of thinking about self-aggregation of clouds in radiative convective equilibrium. So self-aggregation is this fascinating spontaneous transition that's seen in models of radiative convective equilibrium from a state of dispersed convection, like that shown on the left, to a state of really highly aggregated convection shown on the right. So these are map views, so in X and Y, or the horizontal dimensions of the Earth, not in height, of cloud top temperature in white and gray and black. And these are colored black if you see all the way down to the surface. So those are places where there are no clouds. And in colors are kind of a radar-esque surface precipitation map. So you can see that this cloud is heavily raining. Has a big high cloud shield. Some other clouds, say like this one, are not raining at all, or don't have any rain at the surface. Some raining clouds don't have much cloud that's not raining associated with them. And this transition to a intensely raining cluster is accompanied by a big drying out of the domain. So all of these regions in here have a fair amount of water vapor in the atmosphere, but this region that's way away from the only source of precipitation and convection to the atmosphere ends up being really, really dry. And so as a consequence, the infrared energy loss to space increases a lot when you go from this dispersed convection state to this aggregated convection state. This has usually been studied in square boxes, so equal aspect ratio in both horizontal directions. But the occurrence of this transition from dispersed to aggregated convection has been found to be really sensitive to many aspects of the way the model boundary conditions are set, including stuff like the size of the box, which is really, really big here. So this was a super expensive simulation to do. The horizontal resolution, the sea surface temperature, and all of those things make you think, oh, this is awful if the problem is sensitive to all of these things. Is this just a numerical artifact? What do we do? So one other question you can ask is how it's sensitive to aligning the same number of grid cells in very different aspect ratios. So one hypothesis might be that convection usually wants to aggregate, but it will only do so if it has access to a linear scale that's preferential for aggregation. If you make a box too small, for instance, maybe it won't aggregate because it can't, you know, can't develop a cluster in that smaller space. And so we've done simulations. This is simulations that Allison Wing did with me. And it seems to be that aggregation in longer aspect ratios, so this elongated channel, for instance, as compared to this square box, leads to much less intensely dry regions, and that's shown in the color scale here, where yellow and orange are very dry areas, areas where the blue and purple regions are regions where there's a lot of column-integrated water vapor, so there's a lot of, say, more than that inch on average of water vapor in the atmosphere that I cited before. And in these long channel simulations, there are multiple moist and dry bands, too, so there are multiple aggregates of convection, rather than just the one terminal cluster that seems to be found in almost all simulations people have done in square domains. And so I'm going to now zoom in on a snapshot of this and show a movie of what this evolution looks like, because I think it's kind of cool. What I've done is I've taken the most elongated channel geometry, and it's really hard to visualize this way, so I've sliced it into four segments and stacked them on top of each other. So if a cloud goes out here, it's going to keep going along the channel, and it could keep going along all the way until it comes back to the start. These domains are doubly periodic, so if something goes out this side, it will also come back in this one. And the bottom panel now is showing the column-integrated water vapor, or precipitable water, basically the amount of rain you would get if you condensed out all the water vapor in the atmosphere at a given location, and it all fell out. So you're going to see initially random convection at all parts, along all parts of the channel, that sort of gives way to some sloshing around, and over time is going to develop some, say, dry regions that start to form, where there's very little little convective activity, few clouds and precipitation, and also alternate interspersed with moist regions, which have a lot of clouds and precipitation. Over time, this progresses to kind of its own aggregated convection statistical equilibrium state in the atmosphere, where rather than having convection uniformly dispersed across the domain, you have preferentially localized convection clouds and rainfall. And so we did we have a paper on this where we looked at this aggregation of convection in this channel geometry across a wide range of surface temperatures, spanning from 280 Kelvin surface temperature, or 7 degrees C, much, much cooler than the Earth's tropics now, to 310 Kelvin, that's 37 degrees C, much warmer than the Earth's tropics, but not quite as much warmer. And what we found is that we got aggregation across this wide range of surface temperatures, and it took this banded structure in general, where you have moist and dry bands alternating. And so we have some supposition that there's less sensitivity to aspects of the model setup than there are in square geometry, and that this might be a good model system to think about investigating the processes that favor aggregation across a range of surface temperatures. So again, this takes the form, as you could kind of see back here, of multiple interspersed moist and dry bands at a length scale of about 1,000 kilometers. We provided a hypothesis for what set that spatial scale, but didn't really. It's not clear. We've analyzed this in terms of what the mechanisms are that favor or disfavor generation of variance in vertically integrated water vapor. And so we're using a variance budget method to decompose what processes lead the moist regions to become moister and the dry regions to become drier, or which would lead to growth or instability, or vice versa, processes that lead the moist regions to become drier and the dry regions to become moister that would tend to disfavor any local instability. One of my grad students has gone much deeper into trying to dig into the dynamics of this as a linear instability problem at a global scale. And specifically, he's trying to understand how the combination of radiative feedbacks and convection influence aggregation, and trying to develop a mechanistic understanding of how aggregation as a linear instability of radiative convective equilibrium. So one way that this might occur, for instance, is if moist regions of the atmosphere with more column water vapor have less net radiative cooling, and so they can then accumulate more moisture and heat, and that can kind of proceed from there. And so the way that would be plotted in this space is this is showing radiative flux, focus just on the black solid curves, as a function of column water vapor, with some idealized assumptions about how the water vapor varies as a function of height in order to attain a given column water vapor value. And so what would favor instability in this perspective would be if radiative cooling decreases with increasing column water vapor, which would then lead to a little bit of decrease in radiative cooling leads to more accumulation of latent energy in those columns, or more water vapor accumulation, which leads to less radiative cooling, and that could feed back, and vice versa. And so what we found is that we used these super simplified atmospheric moisture profiles and varied them in different ways in order to get a column water vapor perturbation. So on the right is varying the shape of the column of the humidity profile, and on the left is just varying kind of its amplitude with the same proportional changes at all heights. What we found is that we combined this with calculations with a radiative transfer model that are like that's used in this full convection resolving model and that are used in global climate models as well. And we found that if you take water vapor out or add it to the middle troposphere around 500 hectopascals where the pressure is half the surface pressure, that tends to favor instability, local instability, from a perspective of column energy balance. And if you do the same thing, but just moisten or dry everywhere in proportion to its climatological moisture value, there's not much favoring instability there. So this sort of linear instability perspective suggests that the growth rate or instability properties of the system would be very sensitive to the vertical structure of water vapor perturbations. And Tom is currently doing some follow-up work on this to try to use simple model, to couple this with simple models of how convection works, because the interaction of convection and radiation is what would govern the evolution of the water vapor profile in time. And we hope to have a paper on that submitted soon, but it would take way too much time to go into more detail on, so this is kind of just a taste of what we're working on. So I'd like to talk about the second research topic, which is that of climate feedbacks, climate sensitivity in radiative convective equilibrium. So one of the Hennel simulations across a range of surface temperatures, but mostly from the one that's near the current actual tropical surface temperature, is that they seem to have pseudo-realistic large-scale circulation regimes. So that's what I mean by a large-scale circulation is a distribution of speed of vertical motions, kind of averaged at a very large scale and averaged over some amount of time. Obviously, the morphology of interspersed dry and moist bands is not what the real tropics look like. But if you sample that in terms of blocks spatially, so like this, if you take this channel, break it into blocks, average the vertical motion in each block halfway up through the troposphere at about 500 hectopascals, average over 10-day windows, you can represent this as a probability density function of vertical motion, or of large-scale vertical motion. And the real tropics are, configured geographically in terms of land-ocean contrast, in terms of warm versus cold regions of the ocean surface, and preferentially have ascent or descent in the atmosphere, depending on, in part, on where spatially they are in a real geographic sense. Here, there's no geography. It's just what section of the domain you're sampling at a given time. There's no geographic preference for convection being any one place relative to other places. But we found that the PDF of large-scale vertical motion is similar. And so the black line is the real tropics. The dashed lines are just two different averaging time windows that we've used. So in this sense of dynamical regimes or a PDF of dynamical regimes, this simulation looks like the real tropics in a lot of ways. It samples the right range of large-scale vertical motion with about the right weighting. So the biggest deficiency is the lack of a strongly subsiding regime here. This is pressure velocity, which is how fast the pressure of an air parcel is changing in time. So if air is moving upwards, that means that the pressure is decreasing in time. So this is the ascending branch of the circulations, and this is the descending branch. Pressure increasing in time corresponds to subsidence. And of course, the ascending and descending regions are less stationary than in the real world, so we don't really know what averaging time we should use because these clusters migrate and kind of slosh around. But that said, I think this is really important because it means that this convection-permitting model has large-scale circulations that are internally generated and are self-consistent with the setup of the convection. Most climate models don't span this kind of thousand-fold range of spatial scales from small-scale phenomena to large-scale. So this becomes a potentially valuable tool for thinking about how do large-scale circulations influence clouds and the cloud feedbacks on climate change in a model that explicitly simulates the clouds and also explicitly simulates the large scale. A piece of good news or an interesting finding is that we have some evidence for robust decreases in high cloud fraction with warming. I'm saying this is good news, it's just a finding, it doesn't have any objective value. It's a finding that would be slightly worrisome because you're like, clouds are decreasing with warming, which might be a positive feedback, so that's not necessarily a good thing per se. But we do find this systematic tendency towards decreasing anvil cloud fraction or the cloud fraction kind of at the lid of the tropopause, which you can think of as resulting from rising convective air running into a lid and spreading out near the tropopause. That's why there's a cloud peak there in the first place. And it goes away. It tends to decrease in magnitude with warming. And mid-level clouds also seem to decrease. This is talked about in a theoretical mechanism for this is presented in a paper last year, which has become somewhat influential. And a more complex thing is that we have noisy results in terms of the climate feedbacks. So this is, we're diagnosing between, say, a simulation at 300 Kelvin and 305 Kelvin, how much the top of atmosphere radiative fluxes change per unit surface temperature change. And a negative change here means that a negative value means that the system is stable. So the net energy gain by the system per unit surface temperature due to different processes is plotted out together. The black is the total feedback. And so all of these climates that we diagnosed, even though we don't simulate the evolution in time of the surface temperature, the climate sensitivity is proportional to how close this is to zero. You make the climate more and more sensitive as you move the net feedback closer to zero, and you make it less sensitive as you move it down to more negative values. So we don't have a lot of, the biggest take-home message from this figure, so these are simulations in the aggregated channel geometry, and these are simulations in a much smaller domain, so only about the size of half of the channel width and square in size in aspect ratio. So it doesn't, it's too small of a domain to allow for aggregation of convection to take place spontaneously. And so this is a measure of what unaggregated convection would look like in terms of its climate sensitivity, or what unaggregated radiative convective equilibrium would look like. The main message of this just overall is that we find more negative clear sky feedbacks in the aggregated channel simulation, but the changes in clouds just seem to be noisy. So the channel simulations are drier. They have these big dry patches that can act as radiator fins out to space, and that decreases. That's a term from an influential 1995 paper. Subtropics as radiator fins, and that decreases their climate sensitivity. Okay, so this wraps up the bulk of the talk. I want to take a minute or two to review what I've covered. First, I talked about Earth's energy balance, the dominance of water in it, and in almost all of the major flows of energy into and out of the Earth system. Even though clouds are such a small fraction of the water in the atmosphere, only less than 1%, they play this outsized role in radiative transfer, both on the solar energy gain side of the climate equation and on the infrared energy loss side. Next, I talked about the idea of radiative convective equilibrium, or RCE, as a statistical equilibrium of the atmosphere that's generated by interaction of radiative transport and convective heat transport with no horizontal heterogeneity in the forcing. So early studies with single column models are over 50 years old at this point, but they still provided us useful intuition about how the climate is sensitive to perturbations. And now we're getting to the point where we can do simulations with models that explicitly permit convection rather than just need to make assumptions about how it works, which lets us open up a whole slew of other subjects to study. Then I talked about this striking tendency for clouds in large domain simulations with radiative convective equilibrium to clump together spontaneously. and a little bit about the mechanisms that might lead to it, there's still a lot of question about how it relates to the real world. And so I think this mechanistic view of what processes favor or disfavor it is really important. And I finally talked about climate feedbacks in aggregated and disaggregated radiative convective equilibrium with some kind of mixed results at this point. So there's a lot of other processes or aspects of the climate system that we might also think about looking at with radiative convective equilibrium. So there's what I've talked to you about today, a prospect of making progress on understanding cloud feedbacks with warming, but also questions like how does the distribution of tropical rainfall, how does rainfall extremes change with climate? That's really societally important. I have a student working on this. There's the question of what sets the mean and variability of relative humidity in the tropical atmosphere, which is kind of unsolved from a theoretical perspective, but there's recently been some really interesting progress on it by a group out at Berkeley. Also, what controls the height of the maximum level, of the level where cloud fraction is maximized? The same group has done some really interesting work on that. And finally, this kind of teaser that if you set this radiative convective equilibrium rotating, so you add a Coriolis force to the equations of motion, you can get hurricanes. And in fact, the whole domain will fill up with space-filling, piling hurricanes. It's a fantastic thing we call a tropical cyclone world. So I'm working on that too, both in this kind of regular moist radiative convective equilibrium setting and also going into the dry limit to see if there are things we can learn about hurricanes from analogous dry vortices. And these are all, of course, only a small subset of questions that we want to ask about and know about in the real climate system, but I hope I've given you a taste of the sort of work that can be done in idealized climate modeling. And that when you look at the sky or a picture of the Earth like this, that you have a renewed appreciation for how the tiny amount of cloud water in the atmosphere has such a huge impact on Earth's energy balance. So, thanks.